I'll have to share with you my own impressions of Lockheed. When I think of Lockheed, I think of the Skunk Works, and you go into that amazing period in Lockheed's history. These guys, these scientists and engineers with slide rules, and they all get together in a building and create these amazing things. A lot of them were based right here in Nevada at Groom Lake, Area 51. The U-2, which, as you note in the book, came in under budget and ahead of time. The SR-71, which is my favorite plane of all time, the F-117, which has done a lot of good stuff. I mean, that company has done some tremendous things. So my general observation was fairly positive about Lockheed until I read this, and I would say it's spooky.
Well, I think you raise a good point in the sense that they have achieved some amazing feats in terms of technical aspects of some of their airplanes, which then gave us capabilities that no other country in the world had, be it stealth technology, be it the ability to monitor the Soviet Union with the U-2 spy plane. But at some point, I think it took a wrong turn, and it had to do with the just becoming kind of a money pit and really getting more involved in lobbying for government contracts than really producing weapons to the characteristics that the government needed. And I think that's sort of the area in which, we have to be the most concerned, is whether companies like Lockheed Martin and others are more interested in figuring out how to get money from the government than they are in making useful products.
Well, you always, Americans keep falling for this idea over and over about a peace dividend. You know, the Cold War ends. Oh, great. We don't have to have this buildup against the Russians anymore. We can have a peace dividend. We can save that money. And the end of Vietnam War, we don't have to spend that anymore. Or if or when we ever get out of Afghanistan, and that's Afghanistan, and that's a big if, I guess. But it never seems to materialize. There's always some new threat out there, some new thing we got to spend a whole bunch of money on.
Well, yes, at the end of the Cold War, Colin Powell said, I'm running out of enemies here. And in part he meant no Soviet Union. In part he meant how would you sustain a large military budget without somebody to point to as a need. And so their strategy turned to what they thought of as regional powers like Iraq and North Korea, which, of course, were dangerous to their people, dangerous to their regions, but didn't necessarily pose a direct threat to the United States at the time that this strategy was developed. And so, even given the need to perhaps deal with those countries, the military budget and the military industry was much larger than would be necessary to deal with that kind of threat. So there is an element, and even sometimes the companies are involved in coming up with studies, with arguments, with serving on government panels that talk about threats that are sometimes exaggerated, which then help feed the complex and feed not only the companies, but the bureaucracies in the Pentagon, which depend to some degree for their own size on a continuous sense of threat and also large inputs of government money.
Your book starts with what you could call Exhibit A, and that's the F-22, the Raptor. Where I live, I'm just a mile or so from Nellis Air Force Base. I would hear the Raptors fire up every morning, very loud. Very cool planes, a lot of capabilities that have been described by the Air Force, what they can do and how superior they are to anything else in the world. The chapter you write about the Raptor, though, sort of incorporates all the trickery of the trade, all the kinds of things, the rabbits that Lockheed has pulled out of its hat to keep programs going, even when the Pentagon doesn't want them. Tell us that. Take a couple of minutes and tell us the story of the F-22 and what kind of tricks were pulled.
Well, there came a point, there were several points, but the most recent point when Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said, we've got this plane, it may well be capable, but we don't really have a use for it. We're fighting two wars, and even with two wars, it's not being used. It's the most costly fighter plane that's ever been built, and although it's got significant capabilities, they're not capabilities that we necessarily need right now. But the company begged to differ, of course, because it was important source of revenue for it. So one of the things it did was make the jobs argument. They put a series of ads in the Washington Post designed to some to be a veiled threat to members of Congress that if you vote against this, then we're going to point out that there's jobs in your state, be it in Connecticut, be it in Mississippi, be it in Chicago. They mentioned 8 or 10 different companies and states in their ads that would have job loss if we didn't build the F-22. And one thing I found interesting is that they overstated the amount of jobs involved. They talked about 95,000 jobs. They made it sound like if this thing was ended, those jobs would disappear tomorrow. But in fact, I looked at sort of standard estimating procedures that are used to figure out how many jobs $1 billion in the industry would create, and it was more like 30 to 40,000, not 95,000. And it also appeared that a lot of the states that they mentioned had little or no activity. They claimed they were in 44 states. So this exaggeration helped, you know, sort of bolster the jobs argument. But in this case, you know, despite that, Congress eventually voted against it. And I think that was because of the arguments of Secretary Gates, the fact that it wasn't needed, the fact that there were other equipment that were more relevant to the wars that were being fought. But a couple interesting things happened. First of all, you know, we built 187 of these things when many times before they needed had been questioned. They had won the day with some of these same arguments about the jobs. But also they got a little sort of kicker, a little payoff at the end because the $4 billion that was reduced from the F-22 was increased for the F-35, another Lockheed Martin plane. So basically they came out even on the deal. And now the F-35 itself has had cost overrun problems, performance problems. It's not clear we should be spending so much money so soon until the kinks are gotten out of the system. But in order to make the company happy and kind of reduce that lobbying pressure, this money was, you know, spent basically a way to, if not pay off, at least mute the criticism that the company would bring to bear on the government otherwise.
Why wouldn't they use them in Afghanistan or Iraq, just at least to pretend as if they were needed?
Well, in neither place were there it's really designed to do aerial combat with other fighter planes. And so Al-Qaeda doesn't have an air force.
That's right.
Iraq's air force was taken out pretty early in the conflict. So there's plenty of other ways to drop bombs that are more efficient than using this plane. So it really was a case of the adversaries we had didn't really match up with the capabilities of this plane. And also, Secretary Gates pointed out that even current generation planes, if they continue to upgrade them, would give us about a 25-to-1 edge over China even 10 or 15 years from now in terms of sophisticated combat aircraft. So there didn't seem to be a present need. There didn't seem to be a future need. And it was, you know, soaking up money that might have been spent on things like, you know, training pilots, things like armored vehicles that might be used, you know, more effectively to protect troops in the field. And also to just look at whether spending $700 billion a year on the military, which is the largest level since World War II, was the most efficient and effective way to protect the country, whether there was some, you know, fat in the process that could be trimmed and make available either to cut the deficit or invest in other areas.